So, okay, so I want just to mention that this is a series of two lectures. I will be given the first lecture, but Vladimir, who is sitting here, will give the next lecture. Vladimir works in my laboratory. He has actually performed the experiments that we want to tell you about, so I think he's very suited to give the second talk. And anyway, we have prepared both talks together. I apologize, I was not able to, for last minute reasons, I was not able to be here on next Thursday afternoon. Okay, so the what we are going to talk about in these two lectures are superconducting circuits, which are one of two types of systems that exhibit quantum effects on the microscopic scale. And we are doing this, the experiments we will tell you about at Yale University, and I have listed a certain number of people who have participated in the last 8 years or so to these experiments. And brand new results, which we find very interesting, as I said, have been obtained by Vladimir. Okay, so the outline of these two talks will be the following. So today I will cover the basic questions that are addressed by these experiments. I will not explain the experiments per se. I will give you some basic introduction to this field and explain to you the concepts. The experiments itself and its results will be presented by Vladimir. And before we go on, I really want to urge you to interrupt me and ask questions. Don't leave me speak alone like this. Please interrupt me. Okay, so when dealing with the superconducting circuits, there's the first thing that we have to make clear, because superconductivity is often discussed as quantum mechanics on a macroscopic scale, or it's also called the macroscopic quantum effect. So we have to dispel right from the beginning a sort of confusion. So it's not because our systems are superconducting that they exhibit microscopic quantum phenomena of the kind that Tony addressed. And we have to distinguish between two types of microscopic quantum phenomena. One, I would say, like superconductivity or magnetism, I would describe it as a macroscale magnification of microscopic quantum effects. And so that would be the type one of microscopic quantum phenomena. And the type two, which is really related to the foundations of quantum mechanics, are totally different effects. We use superconductors because they are technically easy to work with, but it's not necessary. So the second type are quantum effects which are displayed by a macroscopic collective variable. And to make the distinction between those two types of quantum effect, I've taken the example of a crystal. So suppose you take a very, very tiny crystal, which would still contain, let's say, a million of atoms or so, and you could make it in the shape of this building, that a sort of Pisa tower made of a crystal. So if you would look at the crystal, this is a single crystal, and if you look at the faces, they might make, like diamond, they are going to make very special angles, and these angles result from the orientation of the bonds, the valence bonds at the microscopic scale. And those special angles that atoms like to form when they pile as a solid, essentially propagate at the microscopic scale, and from the observation of these macroscopic angles, you can infer what are the direction of the bonds in the crystal. And you know, for instance, that the diamond bonds are explained by a combination of orbitals. The orbitals of carbon have special orientations, and this is explained by quantum mechanics, and in a way the shape of microscopic shape of diamond crystals result from, you can say that it results from quantum effect. For instance, if you compare with salt, another type of lattice, which you can just explain by piling a billion volts basically in a regular lattice. But diamond, the orientation of the bonds of diamond come from very special quantum constraint, and you can observe this quantum constraint on the microscopic scale by looking at the phases. And you see, this is just a microscopic quantum effect that is able to survive at the macroscopic scale, which propagates to our scale. But if you touch the crystal, it's perfectly a classical solid. What might be quantum mechanical, on the other hand, is the motion of the center of mass. This tiny crystal, this experiment hasn't been successful yet, but this tiny crystal, due to quantum fluctuations in the position of the center of mass, could actually fall spontaneously. It will, the probability, you will have to wait a very, very long time for any observable crystal, but this effect, in principle, can be observed. I'm going to talk about mechanical microscopic quantum effects in a little while that actually are more realistic version of this type of phenomenon. But I hope that you are able to see the difference. Yes?
What sort of length scale are we talking about for a single crystal?
We could take a crystal that you would see still with the electron microscope, and it would be a few thousand of atom wide. This is in today's physics, this is considered a macroscopic piece of matter.
Yes, aren't the plates in the semiconductor industry a single crystal, and it's sufficient to have the same structure at a time?
Yes, you're right. Silicon, if we take a piece of silicon, it has exactly the same constraint as diamond. Yes, it's the same kind of lattice.
I just have a question about terminology. I mean, I've seen different people use the words mesoscopic and macroscopic in ways that... Is there a clear distinction in the community, or is that something that people...
So, the mesoscopic phenomena are precisely... They describe a broad range of phenomena which are quantum, which involve a macroscopic number of atoms. So you can characterize a phenomenon by two numbers. One number is the number of atoms, and we are going to discuss this in a short while, included in the system. And the other number is the number of quanta, the size of the action involved in the phenomenon divided by h bar. So traditionally in physics up to 30 years ago, there was the microscopic and quantum were synonymous. You had, if you wanted to observe a system with a very small action, very small number of h bar, something a process that would involve a small number of h bar, you had to do it a microscopic system. You would observe the prototype example is the Stern and Gerlach experiment, where you have silver atoms which are deflected in a magnetic field gradient in two different directions, whether they are up or down. This is a typical experiment in which quantum is synonymous of microscopic. Now, in recent years, because it is able to fabricate systems which contain a relatively small number of atoms, but still still millions or billions of atoms, and cool them to a very low temperature so that only a few energy levels are excited, you can combine quantum effects with a system that basically you can see under a microscope. But that doesn't necessarily qualify the system to be a macroscopic quantum phenomenon. You could have, for instance, just the degrees of freedom in your quantum system could just be a single electron. This is, for instance, what happens in quantum dots. Quantum dots are artificial atoms in which you have a single electron which orbits in a potential which spans thousands or millions of atoms. So this single electron visits millions of atoms. But so it's an artificial atom in which the degree of freedom is still the position of an electron, but the potential felt by the electron is due to many, many atoms. So this is, I would say, a typical example of a mesoscopic system, which usually people do not put in the class of macroscopic quantum effects. Although we could, we are going to debate during this lecture why actually in the future they may entitled to this, they could be entitled to this. To this characterization. You see, what we are going to spend the lecture on is really trying to explain this idea of being both quantum and macroscopic at the same time. Here, I'm making a rough disclaimer. I don't want you to believe that phenomena which seem to imply quantum effects like magnetism or superconductivity are a macroscopic quantum phenomena. So the superconductivity is precisely an example like the phases of the crystal, which is due to a fundamental quantum effect at the level of electrons, which propagates on, it's an effect which is able to propagate on a macroscopic scale, but you shouldn't take an MRI call. If you have an MRI picture taken of your body, it will involve a superconducting magnet with kilometers of wires, and there is no quantum coherence of electrons along that kilometers of wire. The only quantum effect, the quantum effect happened on a very, very small scale. The propagation of superconductivity in the coil is a purely classical phenomenon, exactly like in a magnet. All the little parts of the magnet are aligned and give you a giant magnetic moment, but the coupling between these individual microscopic magnets is a totally classical phenomenon. So it is only at the, in magnetism, it is only at the angstrom scale, or maybe a nanometer scale, that quantum mechanics operates. And in superconductors, it's the same. So it is very important to understand the type of experiment that we're doing, that you're not, because they are done on superconductors, that doesn't mean that they are automatically a macroscopic quantum phenomenon. You have to add another ingredient, which I'm going to describe, to make them really genuinely macroscopic and quantum.
Can I have a question on the other side? Suppose you want to do that experiment and you want to observe the crystal fall, how would you know that it's due to some quantum effect?
This is a Gedanken, maybe I should explain that this is a purely Gedanken experiment. This, if you would do this, I would not encourage you to actually do this experiment because, yes, there would be a lot of parasitic forces that you would have to fight. In fact, this whole field of quantum mechanics with the microfabricated cantilevers is precisely all about this science of getting rid of spurious forces, which can act as, which can disguise as quantum effects. So this is, This is a very clear Gedanken experiment, but I don't recommend this as a project because it's going to be very difficult. But you could think of experiments more or less along this line. It would be a beautiful thing to see this, but it's going to be very difficult. So what we are concerned about is to take, like the position, like the center of mass of this crystal, we want to observe a motion that's really quantum mechanical. So we have to have a variable that is both macroscopic and obey quantum mechanics. What I want to add right from the beginning is that we just don't want to observe a rough quantum behavior. So just a few wiggles doesn't qualify. We want to do precision experiments that will be able to detect even a slight discrepancy between the quantum behavior and the observed behavior. Because if quantum mechanics has to fail somewhere, maybe it's just a very, very tiny effect, a minute difference. So we have to prepare ourselves with the with doing this experiment with as much precision as possible. And this is where you have some choice, because you may like a very, very macroscopic system, but maybe this system may not be able to be measured, or it will be measured with very poor precision. So whatever effect you may observe might be too gross to detect any small effect. So you may prefer a system which is slightly less macroscopic, maybe less big, but which with a system which you will be able to measure with much greater precision and detect this tiny difference. So when you put all these considerations together, in fact, and if you examine all the possibilities up to now, I'm aware of just two domains of research. So you can essentially take superconducting circuits, and then the collective variables will be charge, flux, current, or voltage, this collective electrical variable, which we learn when we study basic electromagnetism. And this describes the collective motion of electrons in the circuit. And recently, there is another, and this was started at the beginning of the 80s. So this type of research here. There are other possibilities using microfabricated resonators, cantilevers, for instance, or flexural resonators, which are made of very, very tiny membrane. And the position in that case of the main object of the resonator is the macroscopic variable. And it can follow quantum mechanical laws. This is very pleasant for students, because this is just basic quantum mechanics. It's mechanics done with quantum mechanics. So everything is absolutely textbook clarity. It's when you talk about position, it's a real position of a real object. It's very pleasant, but the experiments are extremely difficult. The superconducting circuits have variables which are a bit less clear in the sense that you don't necessarily recognize them as really collective or macroscopic, but it's easier to manipulate those variables. As you know, it's we have electronics is a field which is very mature, and it's very easy to get, well, relatively easy to have the control of this system. So there is a breaking news. So at the recent March meeting of the American Physical Society just a few weeks ago, it was announced that at last that one such system was being put in its ground state. So it is possible to really prepare a single quantum state for macroscopic mechanical objects. This is really a very, very recent result. And one can think that in the next few years, it will be possible to manipulate the quantum state of a mechanical object, and there will be actually interesting links between those two domains. It's possible to transcribe the information carried by a circuit into information carried in a mechanical system and vice versa. That, if you are interested, I will explain why this might be actually very interesting. Okay, so my job is now to explain what does it mean that a circuit has a collective variable. So, because if we take an LC circuit, for instance, which here I have taken a type of LC circuit that you have in your cell phone. So it's basically a parallel plate, a parallel plate capacitor, and it is linked by a piece of wire. The two plates are linked by a piece of wire, which make a spiral. So you have these things in your cell phone, and they are made in copper, with copper, but here we want to consider the same system made in aluminum. Aluminum becomes superconducting below 1 degree Kelvin. And so you will say, well, but there are billions of electrons in this system. Here I'm actually considering the size. A size here, a typical size would be a millimeter of this object. And with these small sizes, the frequency is going to be rather high. It's a few gigahertz. Let me remind you that a typical cell phone frequency is 2 gigahertz. So cell phones transmit radio signals, and radio now extends in the gigahertz range. So this resonator just functions with cell phone frequencies. Now, how could there be only 1 degree of freedom in that system? Because you have many, many electrons. Well, if you cool this circuit down to a few tens of millikelvin, so above, well below 1 Kelvin, which is the transition temperature of aluminum, all the electrons will be paired. So it will be like our crystal, the crystal that I showed you earlier, with all the atoms packed compactly. Here, the electrons are not free. Each electron is not free to move as it wants. It has to respect the motion of the other electron, and the electrons are all frozen into a liquid. It's a bit more complicated than the crystal because the electrons form a fluid. But it's, this fluid is completely incompressible. You cannot take a drop away. You cannot make a bubble. Well, at least you cannot if you remain at low frequencies, because the gap, the superconducting energy gap, which characterizes aluminum, is about 100 gigahertz. So if you are going to shake this fluid at frequencies in excess of this 100 gigahertz, yes, you can form a little droplets. It will break. But if you shake this fluid at a low frequency compared with this high frequency here, it will remain a solid, a continuous block with no defect. Okay, so this is what I want you to think about, that a circuit which make like this contain many, many atoms can still behave as only 1 degree of freedom, exactly like the position of a stone, the position of a billiard ball. All electrons are paired and they behave as a single entity. So, to see how this can be happening, let's consider the motion of this LC circuit, and let's compare it with the motion of an electron in an atom. So, I know that atoms are quantum mechanical and they have wave function, but here I have chosen a Rydberg atom, which is a type of atom where the electron is very far away from the nucleus. Actually, you can make such atom in which the electron is actually 10 microns away from the center of the atom, very, very far in terms of atomic length. And in this circumstance, the electron forms a wave packet And this green dot is the representation of the wave packet. So you, these red bug atoms can really be thought of as little miniature solar system. And if you consider their motion, well, you will have just the classical motion of an electron. So it's not, the electron is not a point, it's a wave packet, but that's essentially a sort of fairly faithful rendition of what the Rydberg atom is. And the typical frequencies of these atoms are tens of gigahertz. And I'll come back to these atoms later. Now, what happens in the superconducting LC oscillator? Now, you don't have only one electron. You have billions of electrons, but they form a continuous fluid, which is totally incompressible. So you see, if you look at this fluid, it just moves back and forth between the two plates of the capacitors. And okay, so sometimes one plate is positive, sometimes one plate is negative. But you see, in fact, there is only only the position of the center of mass of the electrons is relevant. So an oscillation of the center of mass of the electron gives you this LC oscillation. It's bizarre, isn't it? You see, you need to have all the electrons condensed in this ground state. This is what superconductivity allows you. It forms this fluid with no degree of freedom. If you think about water in a fish tank, it's not completely different. If you set the motion of water in a fish tank, if you do it correctly, you can have a very regular motion in which there will be no bubble at all, and essentially one single degree of freedom will characterize the motion of the fluid. You have to be very careful with water. It's very easy to excite, for instance, waves at the surface of the water. Here, the superconducting electrons are fairly rigid on the energy scale we are discussing. Yes?
Actually, here the system is not in the ideal state of energy.
No. Here, the system is in the energy eigenstate of the center of mass of the electron. It still has this possibility of being excited. So what I want to stress is that what is it in its ground state is the relative motion of all the electrons with respect to each other. So the pairs cannot be excited, but the center of mass of all the superconducting condensate can be excited, and this is the motion I represent. So you can get exactly the same thing with the superfluid. For instance, you could have a superfluid which would oscillate between two vases connected by a little tube.
So it's excited, an excited state, or it's not the ground state, or
no. This is in fact, I'm going to show you what is exactly this state in a second. This is just an harmonic oscillator. It's this LC circuit is exactly identical to a mass on a spring.
So the state is something like coherent state in harmonic oscillator, or it's, yeah, that's my question. Is something like coherent state, or is eigenstate of energy?
Well, because technically this will be a coherent state. Yes, it will be.
And the same thing for that atom?
No. For the atom,
because if you see the time dependence,
because the electron sees a 1/r potential, it's a bit different. So, if you want, I'm going to address this question just then. There was another.
Yeah. It's a physics question. Since there's a displacement of the center of mass of the charge in this system, does this emit radiation?
It's an excellent question, a truly excellent question. It would emit radiation if it was, you're absolutely, in fact, one of our worries, everyday worries. Okay, so you see, 4 gigahertz is a fairly low frequency. 1 gigahertz corresponds to a wavelength which is 30 centimeters. if you make a system, an electrical system that oscillates electrically, but whose dimensions are much smaller than the wavelength at the frequency it oscillates, the radiation will be very, very tiny. And that's what we try to do. We try to make those resonators with the dimensions so that the radiation effects are not too strong. But you're right, that's a worry. And I'll come to this point later. This would be eventually a limitation of all these experiments, but it's such a small limitation, we have actually to worry about a much more prosaic phenomena than radiation. But it is an eventual source of loss mechanism. This is very interesting. In fact, these LC oscillators can be made with a quality factor of 300,000. So basically, the system can oscillate 300,000 times before losing its energy. But in all these superconducting resonators, the loss of energy is due to the imperfection of the material. We think we are not limited yet by radiation. The radiation could enter, but at the limit of 10 to the 12. So when we will be there, we will be very, very happy. Now, this is something that you need to understand in this analogy between circuits and single electrons orbiting around atoms, is that here you have a unique electron, here you have billions of electrons forming a condensate. The velocity of the electron here, its analog is the current to the inductance, that's basically where the electrons are the fastest. And the force of the electron is the voltage across the capacitance here in this. And basically the position of the electron is the position of the center of mass of the atom. So this is one of the possible analogies that you can draw between the two systems. We will see that in order to fully understand our circuit, another analogy will be more fruitful. But if you... this will guide you at least at the beginning to understand this physics. Now, this is going to answer your question. So how do we treat an LC oscillator? Well, an LC oscillator belongs to the class of very simple systems in physics, which are harmonic oscillators. So when you write the equations of this circuit, you find that there are two main variables. There is the charge on the capacitance and the flux through the inductance. The flux through inductance is related to the current here that flows in the circuit by this relation, phi equals L, the inductance times the current. And the charge here is related to the voltage by Q equals C, the capacitance times the voltage. Now, this is a big thing that you have to swallow, and if you are interested, I can tell you more about this, but you can show that flux and charge are like position and momentum. So if you doubt this, you can look at the equations, the dimension equations, and you will find that phi, the flux times the charge as the dimension of an action, which is not a proof that they are canonically conjugate, but at least it is some justification. And what you can show from the laws of electromagnetism and actually quantum electrodynamics is that the flux and the charge here in this circuit should be treated like quantum variables, and that their commutator has to be equal to I h bar. So those variables are like the position and the position and the momentum of a simple particle. That's what we mean by saying we do quantum mechanics with the LC circuit. It's not that at all that each electron is viewed as a quantum particle. In fact, we forget completely about individual electrons. They are all frozen in one big condensate. It's the center of mass of this condensate, which, like a billiard ball, obeys quantum mechanics in principle. The billiard ball obeys quantum mechanics, but its quantum motion is very, very hard to see. Whereas for an LC circuit like this, it's much easier. So I don't know how much quantum mechanics you have, but basically this is the starting point of all quantum calculation. Once you know this, pretty much everything is automatic. You can compute anything, any quantum property, any quantum motion of your circuit, once you go this route. And the purpose of the experiments, in a way, is just to show if this is really correct. Because after all, this is what you might end up supposing. This is what this seems to be deduced from the axioms of quantum mechanics, but it could fail experimentally. So all our experiments, in a way, is you can view them as testing this relation. And it could fail at some very tiny level. There could be just a tiny correction. For instance, the correction could depend as a very weak dependence on phi or q or something else. We don't know. But this is what we want to test.
Is this something you can derive theoretically from microscopic principles?
Yes, so we can, I have prepared a justification. If we have time at the end of this lecture, I can show you how one could arrive at this relation. It seems to follow naturally from basic quantum electrodynamics, but it is fair to say that at this point, only the experiment can really judge if this is true or not. If we constantly find results which are perfectly compatible with this, well, we will be led to believe it, but it's an experimental question.
The fact that charge is quantized, does it mean that there should be a correction to that formula?
Thank you, because I have to really again and again really pound on this question. So the charge here on the plate and the flux in this loop have nothing to do with the charge or flux quantization. In fact, the charge on a capacitor is not quantized at all. You see, because these variables just represent the motion of the center of mass of the electron, and the charge can be just, it's very easy to have a tenth of 1 over pi of the charge of an electron on a capacitance. You just set the voltage, and actually the electron charge on a capacitance is rather a big charge. You see, charge on a capacitance just represents a bodily displacement of the electron. In fact, in all these capacitors that you use in electronics in your computer, the motion is of the electrons. Is just much less than a Fermi, actually. Okay, so now there will be also another thing I want to point out is that The flux quantum is not present here. The flux quantum appears in a loop that's closed, and we're going to see some of that later. But at this point, this LC circuit doesn't have any continuous loop, and so flux in that loop is not going to be quantized at all. So the charge on the capacitance is not quantized, and the flux in the loop is not quantized, But what we're discussing here is that the flux and charge are quantum variable. It's not the same thing at all to have a variable be quantized and a variable, a degree of freedom, to be quantum. So, for instance, the position of an electron is not a quantized variable. The position of an electron is a completely continuous variable. The operator, technically the operator in quantum mechanics, which describes the position of the electron as a continuous spectrum. Okay? And so in electricity, as long as you don't have isolated bodies or in which the total charge is quantized, or superconducting loops, there is nothing particularly quantized, but the motion of the electron is quantum. So very, very important to make this distinction. So the quantum microscopic quantum behavior of our circuits do not follow from the fact that charge or flux are quantum. We could have systems in which those phenomena could be completely absent and still observe quantum microscopic quantum effects. Okay, now it's not a good idea to do an experiment on this LC circuit for a lot of reasons, but one of them is fundamental, and I'm going to explain it. So the harmonic oscillator is not a nice quantum system at all. It has a terrible degeneracy. So when you apply this commutation relation to this circuit, you find that you have energy levels, like in any quantum system. But in systems of the harmonic oscillator kind, the levels are all equidistant. So when you try to drive this system, let's say you have prepared the ground state, and you drive the system, you are going to make all these transitions at once. So you're not going to be able to go from the ground state to the first excited state. You will go to a mixture, a superposition, sorry, not a mixture, and a state which is referred as a coherent state or a Glauber state, which is a state that as close as possible to a classical motion of a particle in which sloshes back and forth in this harmonic way. You cannot, for instance, by driving an LC circuit, go from the ground state to the first or to the second excited state. So this is a very very bad system in a way. And what you need is any potential that's not an harmonic oscillator. Anything will do as long as it's the potential shape is not a parabola. As soon as you have a deviation from the parabolic shape, the energy levels will not be equidistant. There will be different transition frequencies between the levels. And now, you starting from the ground state, you can access any quantum level by shining different frequencies, you see. So, for instance, this purple transition here corresponds to an excitation from the ground to the first excited state, and its transition frequency lies here. This second transition, green here, lies at a lower frequency and so on. So, for instance, if you were to excite this quantum system, put it in a mixture, you shine a lot of white light to it, it will, all the levels will get more or less randomly populated. When they will, when the system will fall back down to the ground state, it will emit all these frequencies, and these frequencies are nicely separated from each other. If in the harmonic oscillator you have this terrible degeneracy, that all the frequencies that allow you to address the system are squished and are only one frequency. So there's no possibility of addressing the system or controlling it. The only thing that you can do with a non-harmonic oscillator is try to heat it. So you try to put some heat, and you see if you if you are able to measure the population of the states, you would see a funny population. You would measure that the population follows a Bose-Einstein relation, not a classic or a Maxwell distribution. But that would be a very, very hard experiment. Okay, so we have to avoid this LC oscillator. So we have to enrich our circuits, our superconducting circuits set by at least one other element. And this other element is an inductance. It's of the inductance type. And it's called the Josephson element. And it is represented in the schematics as a cross. Now, a cross is not a good symbol because it doesn't evoke at all an inductance. It is drawn as a cross for just historical reason. It's just that at first, the Josephson junctions were made with a metallic tip banging into another piece of metal. And so you have to look at this cross as actually two arrows trying to meet each other. And we don't make junctions this way anymore, but the symbol has stopped. And that's our Josephson element. So we are going to make circuits by combining those three elements. And the richness of that field is that there are many, many combinations. You see, even if you pick 10 of these elements, there are already hundreds of possible circuits. So there is a huge, you can let your imagination run free. And there are maybe very, very clever circuits that have not been invented with just 10 of these elements, which will have a very interesting quantum properties. It's a sort of Lego set, if you want, a sort of quantum Lego set. But what I've drawn here is the fact that resistances have to be avoided like the plague, because dissipation doesn't go well with the quantum mechanics. When you have dissipation, these levels are going to get broadened, and these lines are going to get fat. And that's not good, because if they get too fat, then they overlap, and then you lose this control. And basically, you don't distinguish. Too much friction makes classical and quantum mechanics undistinguishable. So you want to keep the friction down to a minimum. And the criterion is precisely to leave those lines apart. That's a rough criterion. So we tried, that's the spot we have to play. We have to chase every possible dissipation, any amount of any losses in the circuit, and we move it. Of course, you see, we have an advantage. We start with a superconductor, and superconductors are well known to dissipate very little energy. For a constant current, there is no dissipation whatsoever. The current runs forever. But at finite frequency, there can be a little bit of dissipation in a superconductor. They are not completely perfect, but it's a bit like the radiation we discussed. We think that these tiny effects can be controlled and be made very small. But starting with a superconductor gives us an advantage. So you see, there would be no a priori conceptual difficulty to do this whole field with copper, with just normal electrons. It's just technically much easier, if you want to remove dissipation, to use a superconductor. The fact that charge and current, that voltages and currents are going to be quantum variables have nothing to do with superconductivity. Any electrical system will obey this idea. It's just that you want to keep dissipation to a minimum. So we can describe this element by their value, the capacitance here, the inductance, and for the Josephson junction, as I will explain in a minute. There is a Josephson inductance that characterizes the value of this element. But rather than capacitances and inductances, it's nice to talk about energies. So we convert inductances and capacitances into energies by using, for the capacitance, the charge of the electron, so it's square over 2C is the charge of a single electron on this capacitance, that's a convenient scale, and that gives us EC. And for the inductors, we just use the flux quantum, H bar over 2E. And that converts the inductance into an energy. And we prefer to talk in energies, energy units, rather than in picofarad or nanohenries. Okay, so the experiments that we are doing are done on a very, very simple circuit. You just combine these three elements that you have discussed and you put them in pair. So that's it. There would be another combination in which you would put these three elements in series, but that's not our system. Our system is that you put them in parallel. That's what we call the fluxonium. There is a, we call it the fluxonium because there's a loop here in which you can have some flux. You see, it's two inductors forming a loop, so you can put some flux in. There is another name for such combination of these three elements, a known name, which is the RF squid. And it's not that we want it to look different. It's the fact that made us choose a special name for this circuit is that the combination of energies is very, very different than in the RF squid. So in its original proposal, Tony Leggett thought about this circuit, but with very different parameters. So he made the Coulomb energy to be the smallest of all the three energies, and the Josephson energy was the biggest. That's the order he chose in his proposal. And we found that it was much more advantageous to reorder these energies and to make them in this way. So the big difference you see is that in the order of these two energy, the inductive energy in our system is very small, whereas in a Tony Leggett proposal, it was much bigger than the charging energy. And that's why we call this circuit fluxonium. The other way we call it, the other reason why we call it fluxonium is that this is an artificial atom. It has energy levels, and its energy level resembles that of an alkali atom, like cesium, rubidium, sodium. So we had to choose a name that would end with a yum. Our colleagues at Yale who work on a different type of circuit, which is more like a rare gas atom, have called their circuit the transmon, like argon, xenon. So there is a little game in naming these circuits. As I said, because the combination of inductors and capacitors and Josephson junction is infinite, our periodic table is potentially much, much richer than the chemical, the periodic table of the natural atoms. Okay, no questions? Okay, let's go on. What I wanted to explain in this slide is this Josephson inductance. In which sense is a Josephson junction an inductance? So a Josephson junction is simply a sandwich of two superconductors separated by a barrier that's thin enough to let electron pass, but not too thin. If it was a short circuit, it would not work. And this element is in fact composed, this junction is in fact composed of two primary elements. It is of course a capacitance, because we have a sandwich and there is an insulator. So that's this capacitor that we call CJ. And then there is this cross that represents the tunneling of Cooper pairs through the insulator. Now, in which sense the tunneling of a Cooper pair represents an inductance? Well, we can draw a relationship between the current that flows through this circuit and the flux across the circuit. Now, maybe you are not familiar with this notion of a flux across an element. We learned about the flux through a loop, but not the flux across an element. So what does it mean? Well, you have to extend a little bit the definition of flux. If you take the voltage across the element and integrate it over all its history, from the beginning of time, you take this, you will find this this flux here. You see, if you take the derivative of this flux, it will give you the voltage across this element. So if we plot the current as a function of this flux, here, this generalized flux, we see that the current through the junction at the beginning is proportional to the flux. And this would be the relationship that you would have for an inductance. If you apply this definition to the voltage of an inductance, you will find that the current is proportional to the flux. And that's this dotted line. And that this slope here determines what we call the Josephson inductance. Now, the Josephson junction is a funny element because at first it follows this straight line, and then the curve bends over, and then actually the slope becomes negative, the current goes to zero, and then you have an oscillation, and the oscillation period is the flux quantum. It oscillates with the period of the flux quantum, and this oscillation of the current is actually the basis of the Josephson effect. Here we are not going to be, it doesn't matter for experiment that this goes on forever. If it would stop after two oscillations, it would just be, it would be just as good. What we need is simply a way to make a nonlinear inductance. Anything that would deviate from this dashed line would be okay for experiment. This is important. Now, when you have a relationship such as a current flux relationship, you can turn it into a potential. By integrating over the flux, which here is a position coordinate, you can get the energy stored in that element. And the energy, you see, at the bottom is a parabola, but this parabola curves and gives you a cosine potential. And this is called the Josephson potential. You see, that's the shape of a cosine function. Okay, so in practice, how does it look? So this is the circuit that Vlad made, and he will tell you a bit more about it on Thursday, but let me guide you through the elements. So here, you have the junction. If you look at the junction from the side, you will see that it is the overlap between two strips of metal. So the junction is made with aluminum. In fact, this whole circuit is made on aluminum. So all these clear things that you see is aluminum, and it sits on silicon. The silicon is just used as a substrate here. It's just a convenient flat bedrock for the circuit. The junction is seen here. You see that it has a dimension of the order of a few hundred nanometers on the side. So still a lot of atoms. Now, the inductance is this part of the circuit, and this inductance, we needed a very, very large value for the inductance, and there is no way to make this inductance other than piling up a lot of junctions. In fact, there are 43 junctions here. And viewed from the side, you see the overlap between two consecutive junctions. So those junctions are, have an area which is about 10 times larger than the small junction. And they do not behave, for those junctions, the fact that the relationship the current flux relationship as dissociation doesn't play any role. This is just a way to get a lot of inductance. In fact, this piece of little wire here has an inductance which is 10,000 times bigger than a wire of similar length. So what we have done here is just a trick to compact an inductance in a very small amount of space, because there was this there is this radiation problem that was mentioned. Yes.
So how do you design, for example, that inductance as an element? I mean, is there a way to kind of theoretically predict that shape will produce the large inductance you want, or is it trial and error?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. This is not done by, there's a lot of planning goes into the realization of this component here.
Oh, yeah, I didn't doubt that. I was wondering what kind of planning it was, if it was just, you know, based on experimental design experience, or if it's there's theoretical arguments that just tell you straight away, here's what we need to do. Or if you kind of have to...
Oh, it's mostly theoretical. The junction, the Josephson junction physics is well understood. And so there were very good arguments that made us choose this type of structure. But in the end, you are only sure when you do the experiment that there are lots of things that could go wrong. In fact, we're surprised to see the experiment work so well. In fact, this inductance seems... one worry we had at the beginning was that this inductance could have been rather dissipated. All this fabrication, all these components, there could be only one junction which would have gone bad would completely make this inductance useless. It would be... if there was a slight interruption anywhere in this line, it would be a disaster. What we are protected against, on the other hand, is that if we have one of the junction as a punch through, if there is, it's a leaky junction, and if one junction is shorted, it's not too bad. We have 43 junctions. If one goes into a short, we have only 42 junctions. It's not exactly the same inductance, but we can tolerate this type of defect. In fact, we are not really sure that all the junctions here are alive, but a good fraction of them must be alive in the sense that there is not an open. There might be a short, maybe. But so the three energies that I discussed are given here. These are the energies. And we operate this circuit at 15 millikelvin, which in frequency units is about 300 megahertz. So we make the characteristic fluctuations much smaller than this energy. So we can basically, by just cooling this circuit, we can put it in its ground state. And in terms of macroscopicness, it's about 10 to the 13 atoms. So how did I get this number? I counted all the atoms that are here in this loop, in which is, you know, so all these atoms are visited by the current. You see, I didn't count the many more atoms of these wires that access the circuit. Maybe they should be counted too. We don't really know. I'm going to get to that point very, very soon. If you want to get a representation of this circuit, this is what it looks like if you translate it into a mechanical system. You can take the equation of this circuit and see what type of mechanical system obeys the same equation. So it is essentially a pendulum. The junction potential, this sinusoidal pendulum, is actually the sinusoidal function for the potential is that of a pendulum, and phi is flux across the junction in dimensionless unit. So this round phi is simply straight phi, which is just the interval of the voltage. Divided by the superconducting flux function. This is just a convenient normalization. And this round phi is the angle of the pendulum. The inductance in the circuit gives you just a spring. That's easy to remember because inductors and springs are drawn in the same way. And these inductors really are responsible for this parabolic part of the potential, whereas the pendulum part gives you this corrugation. You see, this is why we don't care that the potential, the Josephson potential, is a sinusoidal which goes forever, because we will be interested in only the first few oscillations of this potential. So even if the Josephson potential would be damped, it would affect the potential here and there, and that would not change anything. So that's basically our system. You could study this system mechanically, but of course, mechanically, it would be very difficult to make the energies sufficiently small that quantum effects would play a role. So we just do the electrical version. So Vlad will talk about this, but by suitably making the length of the strings here, we can offset the length of the strings wound up in these pulleys here, and we can offset the minimum here, make sure that for a small flux here, there is a maximum, not a minimum. So you just need to rearrange the strings a little bit here in this model. In the electrical circuit, it means putting a flux, an external flux through the loop. When you put an external flux through the loop equal to a half a flux quantum, you actually have, instead of a minimum, you have a maximum. Basically, you have displaced this sinusoidal part of the potential by half a period here and converted the symmetry point from a minimum to a maximum. And that's a desirable system because you see, instead of having three small three wells here in competition with each other, you only have two. Only two wells. So the system has two equal ground states, which are degenerate. And I think that Tony talked about this in this section. So you see, you don't need to know anything about superfluids or superconductors, basically. You just need to know just electronics and mechanics. That's all there is to it. Okay, in what sense this system is really a macroscopic system? What is nice about this system is that we can link the classical world and the quantum world in this system by just changing the area of the junction. See, these two energies I have discussed, the Josephson energy and the Coulomb energy, they have opposite scaling with the area, because the Coulomb energy is bigger when the area is small, whereas the energy, the Josephson energy here, is large when the area is large. So if we take the characteristic frequency of this system, which is an oscillation in the wells, and which is given by this square root here. In fact, this is nothing else than the usual formula that you know, 1 over square root of LC. The dependence of the L and the C upon area cancel, and you get always the same frequency. So this Josephson junction system, they have a characteristic frequency, which is always about 10 gigahertz. If you use niobium, it will be maybe 8 times larger, but you always get the same order of magnitude, and it's independent of the area of the Josephson junction. if you want to know how many quantum levels you have in a given well, it is the ratio of these two energies that counts, and this actually scales with the area. And since by lithography you can make the area vary by a lot, you can make the lateral dimension of the junction vary from 100 micron to 100 nanometer very easily. So you see that within one single system, with the same type of circuit, you can cover 10 to the 6 orders of magnitude in the number of levels in a well. So it's a very, very nice system because you can study it in a completely classical regime where the levels are so finely spaced that essentially you can forget about levels and just pretend you have a classical system. And by just reducing the size, you can you can be down to one level. In fact, this is what the fluxonium is about, to choose the parameters of this circuit so that you have exactly one level per well. That it turns out that this is a very optimal choice of parameters.
So when you go for the regime where you have a very high density of levels, so it's almost like a continuous spectrum, I guess, is the idea. So,
yes. So
obviously you would lose some quantum features, but wouldn't it still maintain some quantum characteristics?
Yes, there is, for instance, a phenomenon which is called the macroscopic quantum tunneling. So if you sit in one of these levels, despite the fact that there is a continuum here, almost a continuum, you will go out of this level by tunneling. And this can be observed. This is actually one effect I participated in it. This was the work we did with John Clark and John Martinez at Berkeley in 1984, and we could observe this phenomenon. That was one of the first manifestations that showed that you had to take quantum mechanics seriously when applied to this system. It didn't. And we subsequently were able to observe the levels in these wells. What we are discussing here in this lecture is macroscopic quantum coherence, which will be the coherent tunneling back and forth between two wells, a reversible tunneling. In this MQT phenomenon, the tunneling is irreversible. Once the system leaves a state, it decays. It's a bit like the decay of a radioactive nucleus. But now we are at the stage of observing coherent oscillations back and forth between two different wells.
How do you know it was quantum tunneling and not thermal noise?
Maybe? Oh, yes. This is this was really actually what the experiment was all about. In fact, it's very easy to take one for the other. Our experiment essentially was all the control experiments that proved that it was not temperature. What you can do is lower the temperature and see that the rate saturates, but that would not be very convincing because any residual noise would do the same. No, but we were able to go from to vary the parameters of the junction in situ and observe that the escape was really going down on a classical junction, on the junction which had actually classical parameters. So we can the fact that you can tune in situ the parameters of this system makes it quite nice. You can have a knob in which you have a sort of classicality knob, and within the same experiment you can study both the classical object and the quantum object. So that eliminates a lot of possible artifacts. But if you want the really clear manifestation of quantum mechanics in this experiment came by doing spectroscopy, and we could resolve the level structure in the metastable levels, and that was a very good indication that the system was quantum. I guess that maybe we have to stop at this point.
Yeah, that's an actual stopping point then. Very good. Thank you.